Technorama, interview with Kimon Karamidis from the Interface Experience.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
I want to touch and feel old clunk of interesting computers from days gone by.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
From the wonder that is the Binary Studios, we welcome you to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am Chuck Tomasi, as always joined by Craig Stepp, whom you will be hearing from shortly. This is a special episode of Technorama. We did a story on Technorama earlier this year about a place called the Interface Experience. We decided to reach out to the project lead, Kimon Karamidis, and ask him about it. After a bit of scheduling changes and challenges, we finally connected. So without further delay, here is our interview with Kimon. Well, hello, Kimon. Thank you for joining us on Technorama. First, would you start out by telling the listener who is Kimon Karamidis and what the Interface Experience is all about?
So I am an assistant professor and director of the Digital Media Lab at the Bard Graduate Center, which is a small research institute on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. And our students and faculty work on the history of design and material culture. And an important part of our institution is doing exhibitions to go along with the academic work that we do to kind of build what we call a bilingual way of doing scholarship. So not only do you write typical journal and books, but also doing exhibitions in a way of expressing an argument and often for a larger audience. So I work in our lab and I work with students and faculty telling them of the different options they have to building digital technology into their research and scholarship. And we've done a lot more digital things with our exhibitions and putting interactives that go along with the objects and kind of regular text that you see. So I was offered the opportunity to do my own exhibition, and I decided to kind of bring all of my interests together, my interests being digital technology, kind of technology and learning, and material culture. And so I chose to do a show called The Interface Experience that allowed users to not just look at but also touch and feel the computers from our past so that they could have a better understanding of what they do on a day-to-day basis with computers, you know, what their mobile device is doing in their pocket, you know, the kinds of interactions they have with keyboards and mice and screens, and how that physical interaction really defines the way that we use computers and the way we actually build emotional connections to the computers. We had a lot of people, every time I told someone about this show, they were like, oh, I remember when I had this computer.
Yeah.
It quickly became a very useful trip down the road of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's important to know, even in computing, where you came from and where you're going?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a historian, right? So that's my job.
Right.
And it really was, you know, I think it's always important, but even more so with technology, the whole world of technology is built on these kind of industry rhetorics of buying the next thing, buying the new thing, forget what you have now, it's not good enough, buy the next thing. And the even the tech industry itself comes from kind of a computer science background where technology and progress are deemed good no matter what. And coming from the humanities side, you know, we look at progress as more of a questionable term, something to sit back and critique and consider. So I wanted to lay out a story that allowed us to look back at the history of computing, see how much really has changed in just 40 years. 40 years is the blink of an eye for most historians. But if you go back to, you know, the first mass market PCs, the Apple II, the Commodore PET, mm-hmm. and the Radio Shack TRS-80, you know, when those three came out, it really was, you know, what Byte called the Trinity and the beginning of the mass market sales. That's 1977. We're less than 40 years out. And if you look at those computers compared to what we have today and the kind of mobile devices and the Apple Watch,
right.
It becomes very clear how much has changed and how much we take for granted on a daily basis.
Yeah, and a lot of people tend to measure the progress in terms of storage capacity or you know, processing power. And it's much more than that. And I like the way you've hit on the interfaces, the whole user experience around that. How did you come up with that idea? What was the genesis of that?
So the interesting thing is that I'm actually, my background was as a scenic designer. That was what I trained in undergrad.
Like stage scenery?
Yeah. And my okay. PhD is in theater history. So that was my original kind of background. And so doing exhibitions made a lot of sense for me because, you know, it's like putting on a show. And so I thought, what was it I wanted to show about computers? And when I had gone to see computers in museums before, I had often gone to like MoMA or the Computer History Museum, and they were turned off. They're behind a wall of plastic or glass. You can't touch them. You couldn't interact with them. And they really weren't computing experiences. They were these kind of husks of glass, metal, and plastic. And they weren't really what we think of when we think of using a computer. I even saw one show in MoMA where they had a whole bunch of Macs lined up, but they didn't. You couldn't see the GUI, which is really the most important thing about the Mac,
right.
The GUI. Yeah. And they didn't even have the mouse for a bunch of them. So they just became kind of these iconic boxes. And I really hated that. And the other great thing about our Focus Gallery project here is that it's we can experiment with what it is like to do museum shows. And so I thought back as to what did I want to put on display, and I wanted to put on the display the experience of computing, because that's what we remember. Like, we remember not just the hardware, but we remember like the Commodore, how hard the keyboard was to use, but how rewarding this new experience was, and the kind of coordination between the hardware, the software, and the user all at once. And so I wanted to put on kind of the ephemeral experience of computing. So that goes back to my theater time, where it's like you can't really save theater. It goes away once you do it. And so that was where the interface experience came from, is that like I wanted people to be able to go back and think about the physical and kind of time-based experience they were having with these devices, not just look at hunks of plastic.
Well, when we saw the article and all the photos, we saw a good array of equipment there. So I'm curious, what challenges did you encounter along the way when you were trying to put this together?
So the first thing is, how do you actually get historical ephemeral experiences to go back to? Like, that's actually not really easy. And so I started, I wanted to pick objects that were, first of all, I wanted to pick objects that I could get online through eBay, because we couldn't borrow from other museums, which is what we would normally do, because I wanted people to touch the computers, and you can't borrow a museum object then let people touch and screw around with them. So I had to approach it with, well, what kind of devices would I be able to get on eBay that have kind of through the process of time been important enough for people to save, to kind of keep in their closet, and then be kept in good enough shape to be saleable. So that helped determine some of the objects, or most of the objects, all of the objects. And so from that first starting point, I was like, okay, so then what are the five objects approximately that I would use to cover the whole history of this 40 years? And I wanted to show different stages of the physical manifestations of interface. And so I picked five. And so the first one was the Commodore 64. And I picked the Commodore because it's the best.
It was awesome.
It was awesome, right? Yeah. Okay. Enough
He's
said.
Biased.
Yeah. Right. So it's the best-selling single model PC of all time. You know, it's anywhere between 12 and 30 million units were sold.
Wow.
And it was $500. It was cheap. It had a lot of RAM. It kind of symbolized everything about what happened in computing in the 80s, in late 70s and early 80s. It had really like beginning of the cutting edge of graphics. It had this really amazing audio chip. It had this crazy form factor with this ridiculous keyboard. And it kind of captured a lot of the whole idea of like keyboard based computing. You know, that, I thought of that era as like being dominated by the keyboard. From there, I wanted to do the Mac, right? So the Mac is clearly the most important, like, mass market mouse to come out of, like, initially. Mm-hmm. There had been the Xerox Star, but it really didn't sell very well. It was more of a business tool. But the Mac sells millions of units, and its legacy is apparent, so much so that the computing we have experiences we have today with the desktop GUI and a keyboard and a mouse are pretty much the same as they were in 1984. So I went from the Commodore to the Mac, and the Mac reasserted the value of thinking about the hardware with the software and the user. You know, the mouse makes it possible to have the GUI, the graphical user interface, and they're really two parts of a piece. So then, like I said before, there was this really interesting challenge of how has the computing interface changed, right? So if you look at my desk, I've got a Magic Trackpad and a keyboard and an iMac, and it doesn't look that different except for like refinery and scale from the Mac. And I was kind of figuring out, well, what computer would I pick next? And really, it was the Palm Pilot that I thought was the next change in computing. So it was right. The first time that a stylus becomes really a valuable and useful tool. And it was also a custom-made operating system and graphical input tool that was functional, just like the Mac GUI was. And then it is such a precise, finely designed piece of small plastic. You know, everything is exactly where it needs to be. It fits in your pocket. It runs on AAA batteries. You know, the design of the graphics and the interface take every single square pixel that they could afford because they didn't have a lot. So that was the third object. Then the fourth object, you fast forward to the iOS, so the iPhone and the iPad. And I chose the iPad because it was more of a computer replacement than a mobile device. And that's multi-touch. That's using your fingers without a pointing device. That's the tablet size, which has always kind of been a holy grail of computing designers, mm-hmm. going all the way back to the 30s and 40s of getting that paper-sized computer, and has been obviously successful for so many reasons. And then the last device was a device that I knew was important, but then it really stood out to me once I had a one-year-old, was the Microsoft Kinect. Because I had gotten the Kinect for my Xbox and had played some games with it, and I thought that was interesting but a little gimmicky. But then I was sitting in my living room using Netflix, holding a one-year-old and wanting to change to the TV show I was watching, and I was able to just to yell at my TV and change it. and I realized that this was a totally new type of interface, right? Like, I didn't have to use my hands. I didn't need a remote mm-hmm. control, and I didn't need to touch it. And it really also introduces the idea that PCs are now in other parts of our world. They're in our living rooms. They're in our kitchens. And that personal computing is not just your home office or your work office or in your pocket, but in every room, and opens the idea of the Internet of Things and these many, many layers of how computing is becoming more and more ubiquitous. So those were the real like core five objects that I built the rest of the collection off of.
And next we get the psychic link. That'll be the think and the computer does what you want it to.
Well, it's interesting. I actually think the sixth one really would have been the Apple Watch. You know, and I'm not just saying that because I'm pretty much an Apple fanboy, but as far as physical interface, I think that both the crown and then the fact that the new screens and touchpads that Mac is using, they actually have three-dimensional touch, right? So our laptops have always had two-dimensional touch, but that more the screen that has a depth, so the harder you press it, it really adds mm-hmm. a third dimension. And that, I think, is going to be a profound change in the way we can think about digital space and adding that third dimension. And the crown is going to be kind of a cool way of making compact, non-typical interfaces on such a small scale with the Apple Watch.
That's a good point. That's a good point. For this older stuff that you had to find on eBay and whatnot, was it all in mm-hmm. working order, or did you have to do some restorations?
Well, you know, so the getting stuff to work was really just the five core objects, because doing more than those five would have been impossible. I mean, it was a miracle we found someone who could actually program on all five of those. the rest of the devices are there to be touch and felt, but they don't work. Oddly, though, most of them do work. And if we had had the time and energy, we could have gotten stuff on each of them. So what do I have? I mean, I have a old Atari 2600 that works. I know the Apple II we have works. The Osborne works. The Sinclair works. I think the Grid Compass needs an operating system, but that powers up. The Minitel would work if we had a Minitel to connect it to. The Game Boy works. The Newton works. The PowerBook does not work. Most of the stuff works, and I bought it. You know, the difference between the not working, it sometimes it feels when you're buying on eBay, it's a lot of money. But when you're dealing with a big exhibition budget, it's nothing. I mean, I spent $6,000 total on the 30 objects that we bought.
Yeah.
You know, that would be like the restoration cost for two like 16th century dresses. You know, I mean, and right. And so our scale of
not
money.
As cool,
like,
though. Not as cool.
Yeah, right. It felt kind of crazy to me as I was doing it. But really, that was the great thing about eBay and the fact that it goes back to this idea of these being populist mass-produced devices. There were so many of them out there, it's hard to charge a lot of money. You know, there was always Mac Pluses. I could get working Mac Pluses whenever I wanted, and new two or three would go up every week. And we had backup for the ones that run. So they're easy to find working, and you could do a lot of like custom programming, especially with the older stuff, because the programming was more accessible. The newer things that get locked down, the programming languages get really more complex.
How many square feet is your is your display?
It's like 400 square feet. It's like a 20 by 20 foot room.
Okay. That's pretty sizable.
So, yeah, no, it's great. And it's a good size to challenge yourself to be an efficient curator. And it's actually, I'm surprised how many things we managed to cram in there.
How long does the exhibit stay up?
The exhibit is open till July 19th. Everyone should come. But we're hoping to tour it as well, too. Another nice thing about all these objects being low cost to acquire is that, you know, when you're touring a show with really expensive and valuable objects, you have to, like, be very careful. These, we can kind of crate them up, pack them off, and hopefully it'll go to places like the Living Computer Museum in Seattle and the Computer History Museum in where it's in Mountain View.
Yeah.
There's a museum up in Rochester. There's some museums in Europe. We're hoping that we can get it to go to lots of places, and I'd love to see it go to a wider audience.
Hey, stop by Phoenix.
Yeah. If you guys have a museum that will host us.
My house is a museum. I've got an Apple II over there. I was going to donate you my work slate. That's in the closet. We took apart the K Pro 4. Yeah, we're good.
Yeah. No, it was interesting. The audiences that this has opened up for us are very different than we're used to. You know, we do a lot of fashion shows and furniture. So this kind of is on the far edge of the term material culture, which is essentially like an academic word for like things.
right.
But it was really, it's been interesting to think of, like, you know, if we had more time, I wanted to do a hacking day and like, and get programmers to come in and like everyone could like write code on the Apple II and we have an IBM PC that's also working, you know, people who like to actually sit down and like, what's it like to program on this nasty old keyboard? And how long does it take if you have to save everything to disk? So here's a great story about the Commodore. So when you're creating an interactive for a museum, it has to deal with traffic. It has to deal with the variables of random people coming in. But you still want to create the kind of experience for the audience that you're planning on doing. So the developer that we hired had worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So that was great that he knew the cultural heritage impetus, but is also kind of a crazy, fun, creative, artistic hacker. So we were looking at the Commodore, and the way that we developed the scripts for the five main objects was I asked my students to come up with an interaction that would take 60 to 90 seconds, you know, because that's a good amount of time to expect an audience, a gallery attending person to sit at a computer. So come up with a 60 to 90 second experience and then kind of storyboard it out and make that experience kind of tell the story of what was essentially important about that device. You know, like tell the story of the stylus, tell the story of the mouse and the GUI. So the Commodore, the students came up with this whole idea of like, well, you should load a program, right? Because there's no hard drive. And then you go in and you have to like tell us what your favorite computer is and then tell us why. And then when you hit return, it kind of prints out like a virtual museum label for you and then allows you to do that again. And you can change the background color and the text color and you can play a noise. And these are all the things that were like, oh, my God, look what a computer can do. And then you have to use... Go ahead.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just thinking you should put like Eliza on there. Remember the old chat bot?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, what is your favorite computer?
That's the kind of thing like Eliza does too much for a museum experience. So we had to like pare these things down to like a really tiny amount of information and not too many options. Otherwise, people kind of get lost.
Right.
But so as my developer went ahead, he wanted to develop on his laptop, right? You don't tell a developer in 2015 to develop on the Commodore. It was going to take him forever.
And go.
Yeah, right. And there are perfectly good emulators, right? So there's Vice as this emulator that you can program for the Commodore on your PC or your Mac right now. But once he developed on the emulator, the question was, how are we going to get it onto the Commodore?
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, and how are we going to get it onto the Commodore so that we didn't have to use a floppy disk drive, which was going to break on us at any moment? So he went online and he found this guy in England who is a Commodore enthusiast who developed a little device that holds an SD card, a little flash card, and that plugs into the ports in the back of the Commodore.
Oh, my gosh.
And on the Commodore page, you can load from that SD card just like you would have loaded from a disk drive.
I have seen those. Yeah.
So, and the best thing is this little box that he made, it's made out of recycled Commodore boxes. and it has like a little, It has the same matching aesthetic, like rainbow lines and everything. So that was the real fun that Jonathan had in developing all the stuff, especially for the Mac and the Commodore, where there are these established kind of hacker communities working on it, was figuring out how the heck do you develop a new piece of software for these computers 30 years later. And it was really a lot of fun. And I would have liked to bring that community into the conversation a lot more over a longer period of time. And that's something I might try to do with other projects.
All right, we got to ask you, what was your first computer experience?
My first computer experience that I can remember, I have a couple of interesting ones. I remember having an Apple II in kindergarten, not kindergarten, maybe second grade, and doing Logo on it with a turtle, drawing lines and doing like repeat loops and creating patterns. But the really cool thing is my parents both worked at Bell Labs. So in the later 80s or mid 80s, my dad would bring computers home that were in the lab that you wouldn't have gotten any elsewhere. So we had an HP 150, I think it was, which was the first commercially sold touchscreen.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
It came out the year after the IBM PC, and it had a touchscreen. And the way it worked is it had infrared lines on the side, like infrared.
Oh, yeah. It had a grid setup. Yep.
The first Kindle did that, or was it Kindle? Or no. One of the other ones had like a little thing on it. Yeah.
So when you put your finger on the screen, it kind of, it did like an XY coordinate, and then it guessed what you were touching. And so it only had like big boxes. It wasn't very accurate. But I remember we had a touch screen in the mid 80s and then it went away for a long time and now they're back. So it's kind of funny. And now the infrared is back with the Kinect. So it's the same technology of like invisible points of light. And it sounds like George Bush, but that's a different thing. So it's 1,000 points of light. Right. So that was cool. And then we had like an early IBM PC my dad brought, like a portable, which had like the keyboard flop down and you had the tiny bronze screen. So
the luggable. Yep.
Yeah, definitely in the luggable category. Yeah. So it was definitely a son of the Osborne, you could call it. So those are my early. How about you guys? What were your earlier ones?
Go, Craig.
Thinking all the way back, it's probably an old Apple that my friend and his father put together.
I thought yours was the Commodore 64.
That's the first one I owned, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, in school, I had a teacher that I guess thought I was some kind of
nerd.
You know, I was thinking more like gifted, you know, but well.
Special.
So she was a math teacher, and she would let me, once I finished the math stuff, she would let me go around and start programming on the computer while other kids were still doing the math. So, yeah, I have a long history with Apples in the past, but the Commodore 64 is the one I spent most of my childhood on. You know, I'm literally in the 80s. So I wrote programs, wrote games. I wrote my most famous game I wrote, I say famous because a couple people knew about it, was based on the game, the TV show V.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of like a mix between, I got this thing in the mail on how to do Pitfall Harry and make him look like he's running. Well, I took that and made it where it looked like Pitfall sort of, but you're escaping from one of the ships and you get on the shuttle and you have one chasing you and you're trying to get back down to Earth. That's my computer history.
That sounds awesome. That's great.
I even had a red floppy disk with a black V written on it with a magic marker.
That's awesome. You were licensing, right? You're like, you had merch. You're ready for merch.
That's right.
I remember going over to my brother's friend's house one time. I tagged along with him. This must have been late 70s, early 80s or something. And he was showing me his computer, and I really didn't know what I was looking at the time. He would do something on the screen, and it would turn on some lights. And I think he even had it interfaced to some other external gizwiggy LEDs were flashing, and I really had no clue. It wasn't until I got a little later in high school that they brought in some Apple IIs, and they said, hey, we're going to offer a computer course. I said, well, that sounds interesting. Let me give it a try, and found myself staying after school every day typing in all the programs from the tutorial, anything I could get my hands on. I even asked if I could take one home over the summer break. Hey, no one's using them, right? And I want to keep learning. But that was where I cut my teeth. And then the following semester, the Apples were the beginning computer course where they taught you some basic stuff and functions and, you know, programming language things. The advanced computer course, which was in the winter semester, was learning Fortran on punch cards at the university. Oh my God. Yeah, so I still have a vast collection of punch cards that I sometimes carry around with me.
That's funny. The advanced course was going back in time to a previous incarnation of computing. I mean, it's like, I guess the advanced, they hadn't gotten like a big enough computer to upgrade. That's funny.
Well, you have to think about what the programming concepts were more advanced in Fortran than they were in AppleSoft Basic. Because you had to do formatted output, there were data cards and there were program cards. I mean, the concepts were different, but it started to get you into a procedural mode of thinking of, oh, I can send these parameters into this function or procedure. I don't even remember what Fortran called them at the time, but it was beyond the whole go sub, everything is global kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I had a good experience. You know, I live in the GUI right now, pretty much. But I was fortunate enough to be able to do programming and computer science in high school. And I wasn't I didn't have that great game programming example, like you say. But it's nice to open up to understand the kind of deeper understanding of what's going on in the guts. And I'm always trying to reconcile how much digital literacy I want to provide my students with, how far down the rabbit hole do they really need to know what's going on in the computer, and just understanding like all the electric whiz bang stuff that's going in the back and how computers are thinking can guide them a lot in thinking, you know, oh, I'm designing a database, it's doing this, you know, computers are very black and white, that's literally what input output means, you know, you know, it's either off or on. And and so just like you had the experience with the Fortran, it was AP computer science, I think it was, like what a Boolean is. It's more than just like, oh, I can make a little program that when I ask what Don Mattingly's number is, it'll tell me 23. Like it's interesting, they're challenging technologies, and you know, and that's stuff that this show wasn't about, but it's that general thing I like talking about, is like doing digital information literacy, whether it's the hardware or the software, and not taking these technologies at face value and kind of pulling them apart. And it sounds like you guys get even down to the hardware level, like, you know, getting into like what the cards are doing and the hardware, and you enjoy pulling those things apart.
Oh, yeah. Pulling them apart, literally.
No kidding.
Where can our dubious listener find out more about the interface experience, online or in person?
So there, if you go to the Bard Graduate Center's website at bgc.bard.edu, and you travel through the exhibitions portion of the website, you'll find it there as kind of current exhibitions. And there's a page that describes a project. There's a promotional video. There's a link to the book that goes along with it. There's a really great catalog that we put together that I kind of write about the history of the term interface and how I'm using the word and what I mean by the interface experience. A lot of what I said today, but with even some more kind of deeper intellectual elaboration. I also talk about some choices I made in staging the show. I wanted people to be able to watch each other using computers, because that's one thing we don't do a lot, is actually watch people use computers. We use them a lot, but you can. There's a term called defamiliarization, where you look at something that you don't see anymore because you use it so regularly in a new way so that you see it again, if that makes sense. So it's like you use your computer every day, you don't ever think about it. But if you stand next to someone using a computer, you're like, that looks weird. Like that's really bizarre. I never thought of that's what I look like.
And now I've watched people using a computer, and it's like, no, click there. No, click there.
Yeah. And so the whole show is built around that premise of trying to defamiliarize everyday use and like try to get people to think. So I write a little bit about that. And then there's some brief synopses of the five main objects and how they kind of symbolize these five stages in computer development. And then there's also an accompanying website that you can get to from that page on the BGC website. Or if you go to interface-experience.org. That has elaborated descriptions of each of the objects, really good photography that we did of each of the objects with our professional gallery photographer, and then a bunch of different ways that you can see connections between the objects. You know, like, so for instance, Apple, it turns out, hired Sony to make the first version of their Apple PowerBooks because one of them was so small and Sony was specialized in small electronics. So that PowerBook connects to the PlayStation, you know, an unusual link in the industry that you wouldn't thought that would have happened. And then there's also all these device statistics. You know, when you read about these things all the time, you hear about like you were saying before, the RAM, the storage, mm-hmm. and it is important, like how much it cost when it first came out, how much that equates to in 2014 dollars. You know, we inflated for adjusted for inflation.
Oh, neat.
How many units each of these things sold? It's interesting to see how pervasive some of these objects are, how some of the important objects didn't sell as well, and how their penetration in the market determines a lot. So you can compare those to one another. They're also placed in groups. And then lastly, one of my favorite bits on this supportive website is that at the end of each object, we managed to find ads from when they were first sold. And so print and video ads. So,
oh, very cool.
You can see there's like Dick Cavett talking about the Apple II. There's the famous Commodore ad where it compares the RAM and price to the IBM and to the Atari and the Apple, and how those brands would need to slash their prices and up their RAM to equal the Commodore. There's the famous Mac ad with that Ridley Scott did with the, mm-hmm, the woman, yep, throwing the hammer at the screen, the 1984. So we got a bunch of those print ads and video ads. And I like it because it really adds kind of a cultural historical texture to when these objects came out. You can learn a lot from a period by looking at magazine ads, you know, the design ideas,
what they're wearing.
Cultural prejudices, these are all selling to like upper middle class white audiences, right? That's like, you know, things like that. And then also what is important to different companies at different times to sell the objects, right? So like sometimes it's cost, sometimes it's power, sometimes it's just selling a brand. IBM just sells its brand over and over again. You know, Apple has always been really good at creating beautiful advertisements, which are enticing. So those are a really great accompaniment that I like a lot, and that I think I'm also going to use those as another way to tell the story from kind of a media experience, like how we've been sold the future through these computer commercials.
Oh, that's terrific. Craig, anything else?
No, I think that's about it. I'm surprised you didn't put William Shatner in there. Well, he was selling the VIC-20. You know,
that's it. I totally wanted to put him in, but he sells the VIC-20. That's the biggest problem. You know, that's actually why I want to do this this bigger project on publications and ads in general, is that I had to pick the ads based on the object. And I was sort of like, oh, I'm going to use William Shatner. And I was like, oh my God, he only did the VIC-20. Like, he didn't do the 64. Why couldn't he just done one ad with the 64? Captain Kirk could have been in my show. So yeah. That would have been perfect.
That would have been perfect.
That's awesome. Well, we thank you very much for your time today. And hope
thank
to talk
you.
To you soon. Keep us in touch if you do go on the road, and where we can steer our listeners to finding that.
Great. I hope we go everywhere. And you know, Phoenix would be a good area. And the show is really fun and it's accessible. And you know, the other thing, and I'll ask you two guys to do this when you go to interfaceexperience.org, is you can leave your own personal stories about any of these devices or any device on the website.
Okay.
And so you can see the stories tell. So, you know, Craig, you're a Commodore 64 fan. You should leave a little, mm-hmm, story there. And I'm hoping that the show can travel, and you can even maybe see different stories from different regions, or the computer had a different impact in different places if it goes to Europe. So the more it can go on the road, the better. So
That's awesome. We'll definitely do that and tell our listeners to do that too.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Take care.
Once again, thank you to Kimon Karamidis for spending time talking to us. As mentioned, if we hear anything about the traveling roadshow of the Interface Experience, we will pass it on to you, the Technorama listener. If you want to find out more about Technorama, head over to our website, chuckchat.com, where you'll find links to our Facebook page, Twitter account, YouTube channel, and more. Finally, a quick thank you to everyone who makes this show happen, including our regular donations, of course, and of course, you, for downloading and listening to this show. Until next time, retweet us, share our Facebook page, and find other ways to tell a friend about Technorama. And of course, a binary high five. 101.